content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the April 17th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have President Donald Trump. He's wearing his usual blue suit, red tie, but over it he's got a royal cape wrapped over his shoulders and draping down his back. He's also wearing a golden crown with jewels in it. His head is tilted back. He seems to be screaming in rage at the sky. Both hands are lifted as left hand is clenched in a fist, and behind him is a fiery chaos, bombs going off and smoke in the air, all orange and black. The headline is Sound and Fury, Will Trump's Apocalyptic Threats in the War with Iran. That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Trump and Iran both declare victory after ceasefire deal. What happened? President Trump this week claimed a total and complete victory after Iran agreed to a 14-day ceasefire with the U.S., a fragile deal that both sides presented in starkly different terms. The agreement was struck just hours after Trump threatened to destroy Iran's whole civilization and a day after he threatened the complete demolition of every bridge and power plant in the country unless it agreed to a deal and reopened the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf channel through which 20% of the world's oil flowed before the start of the six-week war. Trump's threat to target civilian infrastructure, a likely war crime if carried out, drew condemnation from figures ranging from Pope Leo XIV to podcaster and former MAGA ally Tucker Carlson, who pleaded with the White House aides to keep the president away from the nuclear football. But shortly before Trump's 8 p.m. deadline, he announced a Pakistan-brokered deal for the ceasefire. Trump called the agreement a landmark that could pave the way for the golden age of the Middle East. Iran's Supreme National Security Council, meanwhile, hailed the agreement as an undeniable, historic, and crushing defeat for the U.S. Questions remained about the shape of the deal. Trump called a 10-point Iranian plan a workable basis for upcoming peace talks in Islamabad, but he then said a version of the plan released by Iran, which called for the lifting of all sanctions and the payment of war damages by the U.S., wasn't the one he'd agreed to. Trump hailed the complete and immediate opening of the Strait of Hormuz, but Iranian officials said transiting ships would have to arrange passage with Iran's military and pay tolls to Tehran. Trump also said the U.S. would work with Iran to dig up and remove its stockpile of 970 pounds of enriched uranium that was buried under the joint U.S.-Israeli attacks last summer. But Tehran's 10-point plan includes U.S. acceptance of Iran's right to enrich uranium. Amid the wrangling, Lebanon emerged as a flashpoint. Iran said the ceasefire applied everywhere, including Lebanon. But Israel, which is battling Iran-backed Hezbollah there, and the U.S. insisted otherwise. Israel hit Lebanon with scores of airstrikes in a single day, killing at least 250 people, according to local officials. Trump said the issue will get taken care of. What the columnist said. Trump's retreat followed a chaotic blitz of negotiations, said Barak Ravid in Axios, after U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff flatly rejected Iran's initial 10-point peace proposal. It set off a fevered round of amendments passed by Pakistani mediators between Witkoff and Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, with Egyptian and Turkish officials helping to bridge the gaps. Once they landed on a ceasefire proposal, it was greenlit by Iranian Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei, whom China was advising to seek an off-ramp. Next was Trump, who was urged to reject it by hawkish allies and confidants. Even some close associates thought he'd spurn the offer right up until he took it. Trump thankfully backed off his genocidal threat, said Jennifer Rubin in The Contrarian, but that shouldn't diminish their horror. A man who holds the nuclear codes threatened the vaporization of a nation of 93 million people in starkly religious terms, warning in one post, "Hell will rain down and glory be to God." It was a mortifying intersection of Christian nationalism, pathological narcissism, and fascist warmongering. This deeply sick man endangers not just our national security, but the stability of the planet. Congress must remove him from office. The president's rhetoric was condemnable, said Noah Rothman in National Review, but to project unflinching determination amid a contest of wills and hard power has undeniable benefits. And it forced the Iranians to blink, said Eli Lake in the Free Press. They've agreed to ease their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz based on nothing but an agreement to negotiate. Meanwhile, having lost its navy, most of its missile launchers, and its top political and military leadership, the regime in Tehran has never been poorer, weaker, or more isolated. This was a straight-up surrender, said William Crystal in The Bulwark, but by Trump, not Iran. Just a month ago, he was demanding Iran's unconditional capitulation. But the mullahs and Revolutionary Guard still control Iran. The regime still has its enriched uranium and functional missile and drone capabilities, and it now has unprecedented control over the waterway through which its Gulf Arab neighbors export oil and natural gas, and has shown the devastation it can inflict on those countries and the global economy in any future conflict. Selling this as a win won't be easy, said Jack Blanchard and Dasha Burns in Politico. But that's clearly Trump's intention. Given the public opposition to the war, spiking gas prices, and the rapidly worsening global economic outlook, he's anxious to move on. And because stock markets surged following his ceasefire announcement, it's hard to imagine he'll resume the bombing. So brace yourselves for a barrage of messaging that America won. Let's count the cost of this debacle, said Anthony L. Fisher in MS.Now. 13 U.S. service members are dead, along with at least 32 people in Gulf Arab nations, 40 Israelis, and more than 1,600 Iranians. The country remains under the yoke of a sadistic theocracy. With his warmongering, flip-flops, and unhinged threats, our unstable, amoral president has done irreparable damage to America's reputation and upended the post-war global order. I'm not feeling any safer. Are you? Controversy of the week, Hegseth. Why is he purging the Pentagon? For the past month, the American military has been focused on the war in Iran, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. At no point, however, did Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth let that distract him from his true passion, the culture war. Last week, after quashing an investigation of the two Army Apache helicopter crews who gave a private flyby at the Tennessee home of MAGA rapper Kid Rock, Hegseth abruptly demanded the resignation of General Randy George, the Army's chief of staff and highest-ranking officer. The Pentagon gave no explanation for his de facto firing or the simultaneous dismissal of Major General William Green, Jr., the top Army chaplain. But reportedly it came after George requested a meeting to protest Hegseth's decision to remove two women and two black men from a list of colonels due to be promoted to general. The former Fox News host has been conducting a rolling purge of women and minorities over the past year, ending dozens of distinguished careers. But to fire a leader of Georgia's caliber when more than 50,000 U.S. troops are deployed in harm's way in the Middle East was a reckless move, even by Hegseth's standards. "We've long known about Hegseth's virulent racism and repugnant sexism," said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. "We did not know he was so committed to those prejudices that he would fire the Army Chief of Staff in the middle of a war." "Charges of racism and sexism missed the point," said Garrett M. Graff in his newsletter. "Hegseth sees the expanded visibility of blacks and women in the military as proof of institutional rot, a product of the same enfeebling woke mindset that imposes rules of engagement and prosecutes soldiers for war crimes. An unapologetic Christian nationalist, Hegseth imagines himself a holy warrior saving Western civilization from ruinous barbarism in all its forms," said Greg Sargent in New Republic. "When he recently implored God at a Pentagon worship session to break the teeth of the ungodly and deliver their wicked souls to the eternal damnation prepared for them, he could as easily have been referring to the architects of U.S. DEI initiatives as to the mullahs in Iran." "None of that is why George was fired," said Steve Nelson in the New York Post. Pentagon insiders say Hegseth has lately grown paranoid that President Trump might replace him with Army Secretary Daniel Driscoll, with whom Hegseth has often clashed. Hegseth can't fire Driscoll because he's a close friend of Vice President J.D. Vance, so instead he fired Driscoll's top aide, George, in hopes that the Army Secretary would resign. "It didn't work," said Dan Lamoth in the Washington Post. In an unusual statement to this outlet, a defiant Driscoll said this week that serving under President Trump has been the honor of a lifetime, and I have no plans to depart or resign as Secretary of the Army. Hegseth needn't worry yet, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. For Trump to fire him now would seem like an admission that the Iran war didn't go to plan. But as the unpopular conflict winds down, Trump will need scapegoats, and this preposterous he-man tryhard could quickly find himself back on the couch at Fox News, hawking ED pills or whatever. That would be a better fit for a man more adept at fighting culture wars than actual wars, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. But America will be dealing with the damage Hegseth has done to the military's morale, reputation, and the caliber of its leadership long after he's gone. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for boldly going after mission specialist Christina Koch spent the first flight day of NASA's Artemis II mission fixing the spacecraft's broken toilet. "Happy to report that the toilet is go for use," said capsule communicator Amy Dill, advising the crew to let the system get to operating speed before donating fluid. It's a good week for elevation after Joe Adell, an outfielder for the Los Angeles Angels, caught three potential home runs during the Angels' 1-0 victory over the Seattle Mariners. For context, no player managed more than four home run robberies over the course of the entire 2025 season. It was a good week for disclosure after former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz claimed to have been told by a whistleblower about secret U.S. government programs where captured aliens were breeding with humans with the aim of creating hybrids that could engage in intergalactic communication. It's a bad week for hypotheticals after a reporter asked Jeanine Pirro, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, whether she would prosecute President Trump if he were to shoot someone on Pennsylvania Avenue. After thinking for a moment, Pirro consulted with her media advisor and replied, "I'm not going to say it if he doesn't want me to." It was a bad week for public health after the CDC paused diagnostic testing for more than two dozen infectious diseases, including rabies, monkeypox, and chickenpox. A spokesman called the halt temporary and part of a routine review to uphold our commitment to high-quality laboratory testing. Finally, it was a bad week for the invisible hand after officials in Anchorage, which levies a 5% tax on cannabis products, announced a $462,000 budget shortfall due to residents buying less weed. So-called sin taxes are meant to discourage use, said a city official. We are seeing that effect now. This week's briefing, the return of executions. States put to death 47 people last year, double the recent norm. What's behind the rise? How common is execution? It has varied over the decades as public opinion sways for and against it. Hangings were frequent in colonial times. But by the mid-1800s, some states had abolished the death penalty altogether. In 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that Georgia's death penalty, as then applied, was arbitrary and discriminatory, forcing all states to rewrite their laws and beef up their systems to provide for death row defense lawyers. Executions then resumed in 1977 when double murderer Gary Gilmore was put to death by firing squad. A steady rise in state-level executions followed, reaching a peak of 98 in 1999 and then declining again. In recent years, the number of states abolishing the death penalty has grown, yet executions have surged in a handful of the 27 states where it remains legal. Last year, 11 states carried out 47 executions, the most since 2009. At the federal level, President Trump broke a 17-year moratorium in the final months of his first term when he approved 13 executions in rapid succession. We owe it to the victims and their families, said then Attorney General Bill Barr, to carry forward the sentence imposed by our justice system. Why did Trump bring it back? He's always been in favor of the ultimate punishment. In 1989, long before he entered politics, Trump bought full-page newspaper ads calling for New York to bring back the death penalty after five black and Latino teenagers, all of whom were later exonerated, were arrested on suspicion of raping a woman in Central Park. During his 2024 presidential campaign, he promised to vigorously pursue the death penalty to protect American families and children from violent rapists, murderers, and monsters. Last year, he instructed the Justice Department to pursue federal death sentences when possible and to assist states in carrying out executions. After Irina Zarutska, a 23-year-old Ukrainian refugee, was stabbed to death on public transit in Charlotte last August, Trump called for her killer to be quickly sentenced to death. There can be no other option, he said. How have states responded? North Carolina, which has not carried out an execution since 2006, swiftly passed what legislators called Irina's Law, expediting the execution process and broadening available execution methods. Ron DeSantis, Florida's Republican governor, has been in lockstep with Trump's pro-death penalty agenda, said Maria De Liberato of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Last year, Florida overtook Texas in carrying out the most executions, accounting for 19 of the 47 state-level executions in 2025. So far this year, Florida has executed 4 death row inmates. A 5th is scheduled for execution later this month. Is Florida an outlier? Pretty much. Upset after 3 jurors voted to spare the life of the Parkland school shooter, who had killed 17 people in 2018, state legislators passed a new law requiring only 8 of the 12 jurors to authorize a death sentence. That's the lowest bar for execution of any state. Florida also passed the Trump Act, which mandates a death sentence for undocumented immigrants who commit capital crimes. Yet outside of Florida, the death penalty has been losing its legitimacy, said the American Civil Liberties Union's Cassandra Stubbs. Last year, juries returned 23 death sentences nationwide. 30 years ago, the figure was over 300. While capital punishment is practiced by fewer jurisdictions, those that do it use it often. Just 2% of U.S. counties, most of them in the Southeast, account for 60% of America's death row inmates. What do Americans believe? Public opinion is currently split, but support for capital punishment is waning. Some 52% of American adults back the death penalty for convicted murderers, according to a 2025 Gallup poll, down from 80% in 1994. But younger Americans are markedly less supportive than older ones, and the share of adults who believe the death penalty is applied unfairly has risen steadily and is now also right around 50%. Kirk Bloodsworth, a former death row inmate exonerated by DNA evidence in 1993, told National Geographic that people often rethink their stance on criminal penalties when they learn how easy it is to be convicted of a crime you didn't commit. Still, pro-execution sentiment remains strong for particularly heinous crimes with clear perpetrators. How much worse would the crime have to be to warrant the death penalty? Said Annika DeWorit, whose son Nicholas was killed in the Parkland shooting at age 17. Why is support declining? Because faith in the system is too. More than 200 death row inmates have been exonerated since 1973, thanks to DNA analysis and other investigative advancements. Blacks and Latinos make up 34% of the U.S. population, but account for 53% of death row, which suggests there is a racial bias in sentencing. The cost of maintaining death row prisoners and a number of botched executions in recent years, lethal injections or gas administrations that take far too long to work, for example, have also undermined confidence. Meanwhile, the U.S. rate of homicide, the crime most likely to engender a death sentence, is at its lowest level in at least 125 years, according to the Council on Criminal Justice, a nonpartisan think tank. And despite the upsurge in executions in a few jurisdictions, juries across the U.S. are returning fewer new death sentences. Today's death sentences are tomorrow's executions, said Karina Barrett Lane, the University of Richmond Law School. If you don't have new death sentences feeding this machinery of death, the death penalty will die on the vine. And time for a few of the best columns of the week. First up, the end of America's shining city. With his predatory brutality and hardline authoritarianism, President Trump is inflicting incalculable damage on America's global standing, said Richard Stengel. And it may never recover. For the past century, U.S. presidents of both parties have been in the democracy promotion business, portraying America as a shining city on a hill where democracy, freedom, and human rights were sacrosanct. As a former State Department diplomat, I saw that America had enormous soft power because other countries admired our ideals and our culture. But Trump is a one-man wrecking crew for America's global image, the ultimate ugly American. He's invaded other nations on personal whims, eviscerated U.S. foreign aid, denigrated allies and praised dictators, and engaged in brazen corruption and extortion. At home, he's launched a merciless war on migrants and attacked election integrity. It all adds up to a deliberate, conscious unraveling of the things that truly made America great. The world won't regain its trust or admiration when he's gone. Like Great Britain, a global force that became Little England after World War II, post-Trump America will be a more inwardly focused nation, an empire in decline, smaller, meaner, less shiny. How the left fueled the rise of nativism. Legal immigration is now under assault by the Trump administration, said Alexander Kustov, and pro-immigration advocates are partly to blame. For decades, most American politicians of both parties supported legal immigration as an unquestioned boon for the country and opposed illegal immigration as a matter of principle. But in recent years, advocates and progressive academics coalesced around the idea that all immigration restrictions are indefensible, abandoning the legal-illegal distinction in the process. Far-left activists insisted that any law restricting people's free movement is unjust. That attitude helped open the door to millions of asylum seekers during the Biden administration, fueling a backlash that helped put Donald Trump back in office. Trump advisor Stephen Miller, an openly racist xenophobe, has sought to block virtually all immigration, including that of skilled workers, scientists, and students on visas. Full-blown nativism is ascendant on the right. To reopen the door, progressives have to admit that illegal immigration has negative consequences and restore the line between legal and illegal immigration. Most Americans support immigration when there's an orderly system for admitting people who followed the rules. This column comes from Turkey. Water is more precious than oil. Middle East wars are no longer fought solely over oil, said Yusuf Tosun. As the region's population grows and the climate crisis gets more dire, fresh water is becoming an increasingly scarce commodity, transforming this basic source of life into a new arena of geopolitical competition. With 400 million people crammed into a desert region, dams, rivers, and water treatment plants could easily be considered strategic targets. Iran boasts rivers and groundwater, but nearby Gulf countries rely on desalination of seawater for much of their drinking water. Kuwait and Oman get 90% of their drinking water through that very expensive and energy-intensive process. Saudi Arabia, 70%. So far, despite taking heavy fire from Israel and from U.S. forces using Gulf bases, Iran has not yet carried out a large-scale attack on desalination plants in the Gulf. Still, it would be naive to believe that such targets, though prohibited under international law, were not on Iran's contingency list. Even if Tehran doesn't fire missiles at them, any oil spilled into the sea from a hit on an oil plant could indirectly damage water production systems. So could strikes on neighboring power plants and ports, and so could cyber attacks. If that were to happen, the cities would become unlivable. A world without oil can somehow survive, but a desert country without water would be a graveyard. The last word our in-depth article, going back to Camp Mystic. Some survivors of a deadly flood at a Texas girls' camp want to return to the site of the tragedy, said Peter Holly in Texas Monthly. The question of whether they should is tearing a community apart. During the difficult months after the Guadalupe flood, Liberty Lindley watched in amazement as her daughter, Evie, began her slow return to the water. On July 4th, Evie had spent 4 hours freezing and terrified, dog paddling between a floating mattress and the edge of a bunk bed inside Wiggle Inn, a cabin at Camp Mystic in Central Texas, in which 15 girls and two counselors were trapped by the churning waters. She'd watched as large spiders, also seeking refuge from the flood, scurried up the walls. Later that month, a therapist had placed her in front of a sandbox with plastic figurines and instructed her to make whatever she wanted. Evie built an island with a giant wall protecting it from the ocean. In the middle of the island, she constructed a mountain with supplies at the top. Band-aids, food, guns, ammunition. If the water broke through the wall during a storm, she told her mother, the island's residents could scamper to the top and stay there for as long as they needed to. During a visit to Port Aransas a few months later, Lindley could still sense her daughter's unease around large bodies of water and gave her permission to give the Gulf of Mexico the middle finger. Both mother and daughter giggled mischievously, but it seemed to help Evie reclaim her power from the water. She eventually waded in while holding her father's hand. As her therapy progressed over the next few months, Evie became more and more adamant about wanting to return to her grounding place, as she refers to Camp Mystic. I met Evie, now 10, and her mother at a park overlooking the Guadalupe River on a warm afternoon in late February. Though we were 100 yards from the water, the lanky girl with sandy blonde hair admitted she was feeling a little fidgety about being this close to the same river that had tormented her last summer. I asked if she could explain why she wanted to return to Camp Mystic, where she'd lost so many friends. She pondered for some time before answering, because that's where they passed on, and that's where they went up to heaven, she said, explaining her thoughts carefully. If I stand where they stood when they passed on, I feel like I'm connecting with heaven. Though her daughter almost died under the watch of the Eastland family, which runs the camp, Lindley has no qualms about sending Evie back to Mystic this summer if it reopens. It's a decision she approaches with a confidence that borders on religious faith. It's also a decision that's driven a wedge into the heart of Camp Mystic community, which was, until now, one of the most tightly knit and fiercely loyal in Texas. I would never send Evie somewhere where I thought I might lose her, said Lindley, who moved to Carville to raise a family but never attended Camp Mystic. And there are not many families, really, outside of the Eastlands that I trust with Evie. But, she added, not everybody feels that way. They carpooled together as children, picked out prom dresses together as teenagers, roomed together as sorority sisters, and attended their friends' weddings together as adults. As mothers, they had children who were more like cousins than friends, even when they lived in different cities for most of the year. Their bond had been forged decades earlier during the only months that truly mattered, the ones in which they retreated to rustic cabins on hot summer nights beside the Guadalupe River in the stripped-down, self-contained world of Camp Mystic. Now, in what felt like an alternate universe, a packed courtroom in downtown Austin backdropped a scene that would have been unimaginable a year ago. One of the most tight-knit and influential sisterhoods in Texas split into two embittered halves. At issue that day in early March was whether Mystic needed to be closed to allow for investigations into what had happened last summer. A crucial piece of a larger case concerning the question of whether the camp had been criminally negligent. The acrimonious dispute over Mystic's reopening had for months mostly played out in the media and in comments on Facebook and Instagram. Suddenly, the two sides were face to face, or separated by a single courtroom pew, often for the first time since the tragic flood. This is a dispute that nobody on either side would have chosen to participate in. For months, the Mystic family, if not the rest of Texas, appeared united behind the Heavens 27, the families and friends representing the two counselors and 25 campers who perished in the flood. But by the fall, as the Heavens 27 Camp Safety Act was signed into law, requiring Texas youth camps to implement emergency safety plans, and victims' families began filing lawsuits against the Eastlands, accusing them of gross negligence and ignoring flood warnings, cracks began to appear among the Mystic community. In late September, less than 3 months after the flood, Camp Mystic announced plans to reopen its Cypress Lake campus, an adjacent site at a higher elevation about a half mile from the Guadalupe River cabins, the following summer. Cece and Will Stewart, whose 8-year-old daughter, Seal, still hasn't been found, called the decision unthinkable, a sentiment shared by many of the Heavens 27 families. The families of the flood victims had received sympathetic media coverage, the assistance of prominent state lawmakers, and widespread public support. But their persistent calls for the camp's closure were beginning to frustrate members of the pro-Mystic community. A sizable number of Camp Mystic families not only quietly longed for the camp to reopen, but also were desperate for their daughters to return. As of March, more than 850 kids had reportedly signed up for summer 2026. Many of those daughters, like Evie, had barely survived the flood and were still grieving the loss of girls and counselors they'd considered close friends. Their parents admit they didn't know what exactly might occur if their daughters set foot on Camp Mystic property once again, from potential panic attacks to re-traumatization. It's a gamble, and yet they say they have no choice but to find out. Though they are quick to express sympathy for Heaven 27 families, many mothers who support reopening maintain that their own children's vulnerable mental health has taken precedence. They describe girls and teenagers unable to sleep in their own beds, their anxiety triggered by a helicopter passing overhead, the unexpected arrival of a rain shower, the sound of thunder in the distance. After a summer full of funerals for their fellow campers, their own trauma has been aggravated by severe grief and survivor's guilt. The mothers maintain that their children's therapists support the idea of the girls returning to camp to process their feelings and be among the only people on earth who can fully understand what happened last summer, their fellow campers. Someone online the other day said they couldn't believe almost 1,000 kids had signed up for camp this summer, said one mother whose daughter, a counselor, didn't lose any campers but still replays the night of the flood on a loop in her mind. I understand it. They're desperate to be together. My daughter feels called to go because her younger campers are suffering. This month, as a crowd full of Heavens 27 supporters and Mystic advocates watched, Edward Eastland, 40, who leads the camp's daily operations, took the stand during the Austin court hearing. A spokesperson for the Eastland family declined a request for an interview. Multiple lawsuits, including the Stewards, accused the Eastlands of gross negligence, alleging that the camp's emergency instructions were not up to code and that administrators ignored flash flood warnings and common sense safety measures. As some Mystic supporters broke into tears and others looked increasingly deflated, questions from Bradley Beckworth, a lawyer representing the Stewards, prompted Eastland to say the camp had a plan for wildfires but not one for floods, despite receiving more than 100 flash flood warnings over the past 30 years and experiencing exactly zero wildfires. Asked whether he had known that Mystic was located in a region known as Flash Flood Alley, Eastland, who lives on the property and helped evacuate campers during the flood, admitted that he had been unfamiliar with the phrase, a shocking revelation from someone living in Central Texas, much less someone running a camp with a 100-year history of dangerous flood events. Eastland also admitted that his family was evacuated to higher ground at the same time that campers were told to remain in their cabins. When asked how he was going to open up a camp this summer for 850 children, when he still could not articulate an evacuation plan, and at a time when campers could wind up swimming in water that could hold seals' remains, Eastland could not provide an answer. For many in the courtroom, the interrogation revealed the Eastlands to be blatantly unfit to care for children, but some Mystic supporters appeared unmoved by the details, viewing the questioning as a lawyer performing a public humiliation ritual with a traumatized flood victim. To outsiders, the notion that a collusive nexus of power brokers is seeking to destroy Camp Mystic might sound downright fringe. But the assertion that urban forces outside the Hill Country are allied against the camp and its ownership were common among Mystic supporters. Some blame lawyers for preying on the grief of vulnerable families in mourning. I think there are outside forces that have an agenda, one mother of a Mystic camper told me. I'm not blaming the families of the victims, but I think they've been used because of their pain, and that's horrific. Other supporters claim outsiders fail to understand that nobody could have forecast the danger posed by the flood, not even the Eastland family. Oftentimes, this assertion is founded on a larger, seemingly unshakable belief that unless you've spent years of your life along the Guadalupe, you can't fully appreciate its capricious nature. Claudia Sullivan knows the Guadalupe River well, its beauty and its potential fury. A Fort Worth native, she first arrived at Mystic as a camper in 1964. She went on to become a counselor and eventually the camp's program director, a title she held in August 1978, when Mystic was battered by a flood that dumped more than 48 inches of rain on the Hill Country, claiming 33 lives. Though no Mystic campers died, Sullivan and other staffers had to move several hundred girls to higher ground. Now 75 and retired, she has written multiple books about summer camp and remains close to the Eastland family. Though she acknowledges that camp administrators may not have had a flood evacuation plan written down, as multiple lawsuits have pointed out, she said that after talking to the Eastland, it's her understanding that they followed the same protocol camp administrators followed in 1978. Unfortunately, this time was different, she said. The families suing the Eastlands aren't her enemies, she said, and she doesn't blame them for trying to find answers so that campers are safer during future floods. But at the same time, she added, to cast blame and to say that people weren't prepared, and this is at fault of the Camp Mystic directors, I think that's a struggle to find some sort of comfort where comfort does not reside. For survivors like Evie, the search for comfort after the flood is ongoing and will likely continue for years to come. Despite her young age, she's already become accustomed to working through grief. A year before heading to Mystic last summer, Evie lost her twin sister to leukemia. Lindley recalls that when she told Evie about her sister's death, her daughter wept uncontrollably for a few minutes. Then, Lindley said, Evie straightened her back, wiped away her tears, took a deep breath, and looked her mother in the eye. Everything is going to be all right, she said calmly. Over time, Lindley realized that her stoic child seemed to intuitively understand, better than many adults, how to process her trauma at her own pace. Lindley is not surprised that Evie has approached the flood in the same way. She allows herself to cry, to talk to her mother about her sadness, or to draw pictures of some of the friends she lost at camp. Little girls she turns into angels watching over her from above. About an hour after arriving at the Guadalupe on that late February afternoon, and after describing her memories of the flood in vivid detail, Evie decided, unexpectedly, that the time was right. She wanted to approach the river for the first time since last July. A few minutes later, at the Guadalupe's edge, mother and daughter squatted beside the water. Growing emotional, Lindley admitted that she still felt angry at the river. She asked her daughter how she felt. Evie ignored her mother's question. Instead, she gently swept her fingertips across the top of the water, like a brush across a canvas. The water rippled outward, little circles growing bigger, and a smile spread across her face. This was adapted from a story originally published in Texas Monthly. Read one of the technology articles today. Artemis 2, another giant leap for mankind. The Artemis astronauts have gone the distance, the longest in human history, said Micah Maidenberg in the Wall Street Journal. NASA's Artemis 2 mission to orbit the moon was a space flight of many firsts. It was the first time since 1972 that humans have traveled outside of Earth's orbit. The crew, led by Commander Reid Wiseman, included the first black astronaut ever to go around the moon, Victor Glover, the first woman, Christina Koch, and the first Canadian, Jeremy Hansen. And their mission was a first for distance, sending them 248,655 miles from Earth to surpass the record set by Apollo 13 in 1970. Because the flight was a test for future missions to construct a base on the surface, they did not land. But they did uncover some kinks, including an unusual smell in the spacecraft and trouble with venting the toilets. From a strictly scientific view, we don't need to send humans up there, said Gregory Asimakis in the Houston Chronicle. There's a better, less expensive, less risky, and more effective way to explore the cosmos, robots. NASA has launched many exploratory probes, including five rovers, to Mars. These are more than capable of further space exploration at a fraction of Artemis' cost. Planting humans on the moon merely makes for good images. Yet there's a new space race on, said Georgina Torbett in The Verge. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty specifies that nations can't claim sovereignty over anybody in space. But China never signed it, and it aims to pull off a crewed landing by 2030 so it can start building a lunar base and begin mining. Whoever gets there first will have a huge advantage. For most Americans, the Artemis II launch has come out of nowhere, said Ross Anderson in The Atlantic. The rocket rides in the 1960s were sold as history's grandest adventure. But the Apollo program has since lost some of its aura, in part because it did not lead to a glorious space future. Even now, this launch is not to Mars or to the outer planets or the stars, but just to the moon again. Feels a bit like a nostalgia act. In fact, it's much more than that. Artemis II is both a beginning and an end, said David W. Brown in The New Yorker. The moon mission marks the start of a new purpose for NASA and the end of the old way of doing things. Artemis II was built by the same engineers as Apollo, but starting with Artemis III next year, NASA will neither build nor own its crafts. It will basically hire a rideshare service from private companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin. When spaceflight is no longer the project of a nation but a billionaire's, one wonders if it will still live up to the NASA's motto, for the benefit of all. And we're on the Talking Points page. Hassan Piker, too toxic for Democrats. Should Democrats shun Hassan Piker? Asked Lauren Egan in the Bulwark. The irreverent far-left live streamer, who has nearly 5 million subscribers between his YouTube and Twitch channels, has become a litmus test for the party. Some progressives view Piker, a 34-year-old video gamer and gym bro, as a liberal Joe Rogan who can reach tuned-out young white men. Operatives have hustled to get their candidates booked on his stream, which runs 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. Recent Democratic guests include Tom Steyer, who's running for governor of California, and Abdul El Sayed, a U.S. Senate candidate in Michigan, who invited Piker to campaign with him on college campuses. But many Democrats say Piker's extremism should be disqualifying. A self-described Marxist, he said that it didn't matter if rape happened on October 7th, and that Hamas is 1,000 times better than the fascist settler colonial apartheid state of Israel. Piker has also used the C word and other misogynistic slurs. Piker's language sometimes is unfortunate, said Aaron Regenberg in the New Republic. But moderate third way Democrats have, in bad faith and without context, seized on a few moments from almost 20,000 hours of entirely unscripted, off-the-cuff streaming. The son of Turkish Muslim immigrants, he is an anti-Zionist but not an anti-Semite, and in fact has warned that anti-Semitism is a canary in the coal mine of fascism. Piker didn't condone Hamas sexual violence against Israeli women, but argued that the attacks didn't justify Israel's subsequent bombing and killing in Gaza. Why any Democrat would want to associate with Piker is baffling, said Michael A. Cohen in MS.Now. A recent poll found that just 55% of Democrats have ever heard of him, and of those, only 13% of them view him favorably. Given his history of toxic comments, going on his live stream show is a potential liability. Sure, Piker can be an insufferable jerk, said Jesse Singal in his Substack newsletter. But Democrats he interviews don't need to endorse his views. Piker appeals primarily to young, disillusioned males who are looking to rebel. In 2020, many in his cohort voted for Donald Trump. It's unfortunate that young dudes are drawn to transgressive loudmouths, but to win back power, Democrats must go to war with the potential voters they have, not the potential voters they want. Trump's budget, defense over daycare. All guns, no butter, said Neil Irwin in Axios. That's the gist of the 2027 fiscal year budget President Trump proposed last week, which includes an unprecedented $1.5 trillion for the Pentagon, 42% increase over 2026, dramatic cuts in non-defense discretionary spending. The budget document shears off $15.8 billion in healthcare-related spending and cuts well over half the funding for the National Science Foundation, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Small Business Administration. Trump's ill-timed ramp at an Easter lunch encapsulated his budget's priorities, said Aaron Blake in CNN.com. We're fighting wars, Trump said. It's not possible for us to take care of daycare, Medicaid, and Medicare. Actually, Trump is meeting the moment on defense, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Military spending makes up only 3% of our GDP, half the Pentagon share in the 1980s, resulting in a shrunken military-industrial base that has been exposed by the wars in Iran and Ukraine. We have retired more warships than we have commissioned in recent years, and burned through over 850 Tomahawk missiles in Iran while producing under 100 annually. Trump's budget allocates $65.8 billion for 18 new warships and provides critical funding for new drone models and munitions. The budget makes no serious effort to rein in our eye-watering $39 trillion national debt or the entitlements fueling it, but it shows a welcome new realism about the serious threats America faces, particularly from China. Our domestic needs are no less real, said Bobby Kogan in MS.Now. But Trump's budget proposes to shrink the share of discretionary spending to its lowest level since at least Dwight D. Eisenhower's presidency. Even many congressional Republicans won't endorse outlandish cuts to domestic programs while adding tens of billions to defense. When he first ran for president, Trump presented himself as a different kind of Republican, said Jonathan Cohn in The Bulwark. He vowed to stop trying to police the world, to focus on jobs and benefits for the middle class, and to protect safety net programs like Social Security and Medicare. But voters have already been badly hurt by the GOP's refusal to extend Obamacare subsidies, and 70% say the Iran war isn't worth it. They may now conclude that their priorities and Trump's have diverged. To remind them of that before the midterm elections, Democrats can just run ads playing his remarks verbatim. And with just a little time left, we've got on the poll watch, 64% of Americans are not confident in President Trump's decisions on Iran. 35% are confident. 69% are concerned about higher gas prices as a result of the war, including 45% who are extremely concerned. And we'll finish with a quote from Edgar Degas, quoted in the Carolina Journal, who says, "Art is not what you see, but what you make others see." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.